My thoughts have recently just been there, and I can't make a conscious choice. Just been there, and I can't make a conscious choice to act or not on them. It is a comfortable place to be. What should I do next? I don't know. If you were in a comfortable place, I would stay in the comfortable place. That sounds like that's the top priority. And it sounds like some kind of a debate is going on in the background, but it is not causing any discomfort or anything like that. I would just let it go and see if it goes away. A lot of problems that come up in my head that seem important, if I ignore them, and I just say, I got it. I'm going to take that up tomorrow. That's another way of working with these thoughts that come in, is to acknowledge them and tell them you're going to take it up tomorrow. And they're all good. So then they go get quiet. And they don't come back tomorrow. A lot of times it just doesn't show up again. I don't know if that's what this writer was saying. But if you're in a comfortable place, I would just stay comfortable. I might be misreading that, but that was my best shot. Well, this is interesting. When God speaks to you, do you ever hear an actual voice? Well, I've talked to people that have, and I believe them. Even though the voice might be generated through our thinking, I believe that some people have. The first thing that happened to me, I had about 6 or 7 months, and I was a nervous wreck. I was in the Marine Corps driving around Quantico. Drinking, you know, and smoking, and just blah, 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 and just, you know, you can just feel the bundle of nerves just going. And I'd sit at meetings, and my legs are jiggling, and, you know, just that. Ah. And I just was driving along, and there wasn't a voice, but I was told that as long as I stuck with AA, everything would be fine. And I believed it. And now, if there had been a microphone in the car, nobody would have heard anything. But it had the effect on me as if the voice spoke those words, because I felt wonderful about it. I was still a nervous wreck, but I felt absolutely sure of the course that I was now on, even though I couldn't see it. So, has anybody here actually heard a voice? Just out of curiosity, and you wouldn't mind? Okay. Yes, there's one. I know that this is not that unusual. Okay. Have you had moments of utter confusion and frustration, not wanting to do anything, but feeling you have to do something with this feeling? Of course I've had these feelings. I wouldn't be a human being if I didn't have these feelings. The question is, how much power do these feelings have over us? I mean, who doesn't have... I don't know whether to go this way or that way. What did we say in the... I don't know whether to shoot or go blind. That was the the description of this when I was in the Marine Corps. I don't know, you know, just on and on. So I think that's a... to have that sense in the middle of some kind of fast-moving situation, you got to make decisions, you got to do this, you got to do that. And they happen now, but the impact of this is sort of a mild sense of frustration. I had that Monday when coming out here, the plane is late, I might not ever get here, I'm going to stand in line forever, you know. And eventually I just got a yogurt thing and sat down and started eating it. And I started thinking about how good that damn yogurt, you know, if you mix chocolate and vanilla, it's just perfect. And by the time I got to the bottom of the cup, I was totally enjoying the yogurt. And the problem was yapping away somewhere, you know, that, oh, you're not going to get there until Saturday night. What a waste of time. You know, it's so easy to get, should you try and get another plane out? You know, all that. And so yogurt is a damn good answer to these things. And everybody has their own way of refocusing on getting centered, whatever it is. And if you don't, try to start developing those where you can just step out of the role of being totally confused into a quiet place. And the problem starts resolving itself. It just starts, or as I read earlier, or it starts going away. All right. Regarding relationships, can you talk about the difference between tolerance and acceptance, and between acceptance and compliance with their demands? I think what we have in here are spiritual and non-spiritual terms combined. So in other words, the difference between tolerance and acceptance is spiritual and tolerance isn't. In other words, if I accept something, that means I'm comfortable with it, so I don't need to tolerate it. It's been accepted. And I have worked so that it isn't bothering me. Acceptance and compliance. Compliance is non-spiritual. Acceptance is spiritual. Compliance is there is a sense of willfulness that it's wrong, but I'm going to go along with it anyway. Whereas acceptance, I'm back in God's hands, a child of God, and events are taking place. Compliance means, it's just in the word itself, it's saying, I don't want it to be this way, but I'm going to go along. And so that would be mine. And I realize when you're in the middle of these things, it looks like there's no answer. And since there's no answer, we're letting go of the whole situation. Just, I have no idea how this all works out. I'll just wait and get contacted by God as to how this works out, instead of trying to fix it. Right, Steve?
Right.
Okay. In reference to the question about making a decision to overcome bad work habits, inertia, etc., is not the underlying problem fear, and isn't a more rigorous approach? Rigorous means I'm going to come up with the solution. Anytime rigorous, I am the one who is going to cause the change. Allowing God to do it is not rigorous. It is, and we go, well, then why don't we just let God help us with all these problems? We don't want him in our life that much. It's like the feeling that the people have about the federal government sometimes. Yeah, I'd like some help, but not that much. And so there's a resistance to relying on God in all matters. There's a sense that I ought to be able to do something about it myself. And I'm just a big believer in whatever is bothering me, to let it go and allow God to come in and give me the answer to it. I know it sounds more practical to come up with some way of getting off your butt and getting to, I've got to get out and I'm going to do those things. But when the decision comes to do that, it'll come from God. And we'll see. I think there's a question in here that covers something I want to make a point in that area. I have a problem with being honest and faithful with female girlfriends, and a problem with lust and can't stop. Meanwhile, enjoy something callousness of being with one person. Closeness of being with one person. This was probably written by a man. I'm just guessing that. Problems with being faithful and problems with lust. Now, would everyone here who has never had a problem with this raise their hand? Isn't that interesting? Now, I'm not talking about acting on it, but feeling like acting on it and thinking about acting. You know, you can have an affair mentally, and it doesn't count because you didn't actually have it. But you know you had it, and you feel less about yourself. And so eventually even that starts becoming a problem. And so it is, well, there's two ways. One is, we're going to hit a bottom with this stuff. We're going to, you know, get caught again and again and develop the reputation throughout the program. Don't go out with that guy. I can tell you what's going to happen. I mean, circumstances themselves can bring things like this to a bottom, and we acquire humility through humiliation, which is one way of getting it. That's how most of us hard-headed guys do get humility, is through humiliation. And finally we just go, okay, enough of that. Maybe you end up on television or something, you know what I mean? With me, first, I had to accept that I was powerless over lust. That I didn't like accepting that. I thought that I should be able to do something about it. I don't know why I put that one in the category that I ought to be able to do something about it. Probably some childhood training that was such a no-no. And when the feeling comes, I just accept it. I don't magnify it. I just go, well, there's that lust feeling. I mean, it's there. And gradually, I have found, now maybe it's age is contributing to that, that it is not as big a problem as it used to be. I just honestly think the other side of that is to allow the remarkable closeness of total unity with one person to override everything. And that experience is really unique. It used to be a lot stronger when I was in college. You could count on one hand the number of guys that had had sex. I know it sounds impossible in this day and age. There were a lot of guys that talked about it, but there really weren't that many. And people got married, and both people were virgins. And they started their life together from that point. And, of course, that's not the case now. So we miss out on that experience. And it can be recaptured with this closeness with one person and the commitment to the relationship or the marriage as something sacred that we want to be part of. And again, it's being part of something. You see what I'm talking about? In other words, the relationship becomes the greater thing than either person. That'll never be answered. For you, what's the difference between God's will and your will? I wrestled with this for a long time over free will and God. And I finally came up with my particular answer to this. And this is how I got there. What could you have done to get sober 2 years earlier? There's a question for you. What could you have done to have gotten to AA 2 years sooner? Now, if you really wrestle with that, you're probably going to say, nothing. I had to hit my bottom. That's what most people would say to a question like that. So that meant that you were powerless over getting sober any sooner. So then you might take it one step further. What could you have done to have gotten higher grades in college? Now, if you really go through that, you go, nothing. Well, I could have studied harder, but I'm not the type of guy who would have studied harder. So, no, I couldn't have done anything to have gotten. What could you have done to not have that lousy girlfriend in high school? And then when you go back and you really think about it, you realize, nothing. And as you go back with all the events in the past and ask yourself how you could have caused them to be different, and I reached the same conclusion, I couldn't have caused anything to be different. So that showed that I had very little control over my past as I look at it from now. So why do I think I can have any influence on the future? Why do I think that my free will has any effect on anything? So suddenly, you hear me working myself into the predestination corner. Well, there you are. It's all going to turn out the way God wanted it. And so I would go, yeah, that's true. Well, then where does free will come in? Free will is how we describe the events. In other words, the free will is the adjectives that we're putting on everything. So I was destined to have this girlfriend in high school, and I called it the worst girlfriend that you could have and classified it as an awful, terrible experience. So I actually, through my will, had a terrible experience, even though it was one that was going to happen anyway. And so that's how I've been able to. And of course, as I create the story about the event, that's the reality that I live in. So in a way, free will has dominated my whole life. And that's just the way I see that one. Well, I can tell it's right after lunch. I'm having a hard time staying awake. How do you differentiate between someone who is truly suffering from a criminal disorder as opposed to someone who's suffering from untreated alcoholism? Oh, clinical disorder. I think I covered this earlier, that if I suspect that that's what it is, I always like to get my doctor friends to give me advice, and they might be in my group, and I'll just go, you know, John, and I'm working with him, and these certain symptoms, do you see them in the thing? And if I can get an idea from him that there is something, because I certainly can't make a diagnosis, but we certainly know that something doesn't look normal. I mean, just common sense. You've been with new people for 20 years, and here's a thinking pattern or a behavior pattern that is like, wow, I never saw that one before. And so that opens the possibility that there is some clinical disorder. And sometimes, unless the clinical disorder is addressed, it's really hard to work with the people. At least that's been my experience. It's just, boy, manic depressives are just extremely difficult. And when they get things under control, there's just a lot better. So I don't try to tell the difference. If I suspect it, I try to get an expert to help me understand that. Can you speak about your earlier comment regarding the distinction between trying to stop smoking over 8 years and finally making a decision to stop smoking? In other words, well, why didn't I make the decision after 6 years? Why did I wait 8 years of thinking about stopping smoking? Why didn't I? And my only answer is, I wasn't supposed to stop any sooner. That's when I was supposed to stop. And then I don't have to get all over my case that I should have done better. This is a common thing that I can use to beat myself up. I should have done better. And I think that if I punish myself enough, I will do better. By beating myself up more, that I will do better. I'm convinced that that's when I was supposed to stop. And that's the end of that story. And if I wasn't supposed to stop, then I was supposed to get lung cancer. I'm just not in the business of saying I can control anything. Why do 90% of the alcoholics die from alcoholism and only 10% of us get in here? Trying to figure that stuff out will ruin serenity. It's just like, I don't know, why do volcanoes bury people? Don't you think they should be more sensitive? Why don't we work on that one for a while? So my feeling is that I stopped when I was supposed to stop. Yes?
And could you tell us your story?
About smoking?
About your life story.
My life story?
Your bottom.
My life story. Well, all right, in 5 minutes. No, let me see. Yeah, that'd probably be more interesting than trying to address all these. Let's see, I grew up in Connecticut. I had polio as a kid. I was in a Catholic church. The church frightened me. I just was scared to death in this whole setting. My sister was sitting next to me, loved it. So it's not the church, it was my... This is what I've concluded later on. This has got nothing to do with my life story, but I've concluded that... my ego really took off when we moved from West Haven to Woodbridge, Connecticut, which was in first grade. And I was coming home, I was walking back to our house, and it went by a swampy area, and there was a log in the swamp that if you really stretched your imagination, you could say was an alligator. And I looked over and I went, there's an alligator over there. To me, that's an alligator. And then I kept looking and picturing it more like an alligator. And pretty soon, I was running home from the pond. It was this freaking alligator. And I didn't tell anybody. I didn't tell my mother. She would say, there's no alligators in Connecticut. And it would ruin the whole routine that I have going with myself. Because being afraid of this alligator was kind of exciting. It was more action than I'd had in quite a while. What are you doing this afternoon? I'm running from a freaking alligator back there. And, you know, it seemed kind of exciting. And then I got in my room that night and I heard a rustling. And I knew there was an alligator. The alligator got in the room. And that made it even more. I'm like, oh, I'm on the bed. And I'm going, freaking alligator. And I think, and of course, the part of me that's making up that story is my ego. And I think he saw that I liked it. So he said, well, if this guy likes it, watch this. And he just kept on going. Not only is there an alligator, but no one in the world likes you.
Really?
Oh, my God, that's even worse. There's an alligator in here and no one likes me. And then I would react to that. Well, I'm sad and frightened. And I think that's the beginning of this great story to move me into the world of think it up and feel it. Think it up and feel it. Think it up and feel it. So I don't see my ego as a bad person. I don't see it as a bad part of me. I just see it as, well, I thought you were enjoying this. So I just kept it up. I've just been doing this, and I'm sorry. I didn't know it was really bothering you this much and ruin your entire life. And so as a result, I named my ego. Some of you may have heard this, but I have a name for my ego. And his name is Frank Morgan. Frank Morgan is the actor who played the Wizard of Oz. And if you remember the movie, the wizard is behind this screen, and he's got some micro, well, there's a wicked witch in the room, and then everybody's so terrified by all these things, and Dorothy goes up, pulls the screen away, and he's back there. He's a little guy, just rah, 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 and then he sees everybody can see him, and he goes, oh, never mind. And it turned out he was just a businessman that got lost and suckered into this thing, and he wants to go home too. So I'm concluding that my ego wants to get reunited with God just as much as I do. And he really isn't my arch enemy, but I made him that. So that's how the separation. So that probably helped me make up the story about the horrible church, and they're gathering evidence at the confessional, and they're going to use it against me later, and all of these things. But basically, I managed to go to a good prep school, pump right into Yale University. I started drinking down there, barely graduated, joined the Marine Corps in the Korean War, became a fighter pilot, got married, had 6 children, two of which are in AA now, and 1 grandchildren. I have 15 grandchildren. And the drinking got so bad, I was flying around in alcoholic withdrawal, which is more dangerous than flying with booze, with half drunk, because it just is. You could have a seizure at any moment. Your heart is racing. I would sometimes fly with my hand on the ejection seat, and I thought maybe if I passed out, I'd eject. Plane would crash. The chute opens at 10,000 feet. Problem solved. That was the part that I liked the best, was that I said, well, you had a problem, but now you don't. But we accept it as good solutions. Was insanity, and so eventually I had a grand mal seizure. I got locked up in the nut ward for 6 months because they didn't have an alcohol program. Some AA guys talked their way in, and after 4 months, I was able to go home as an outpatient, and after 2 weeks, I started smuggling vodka back into the nut ward. Even though they told me if I ever had another drink, my career was over. I had had a drink over the weekend, and that just left. So I was about to get totally exposed, and that's when I dialed Alcoholics Anonymous, and my sponsor came over and got me, and I haven't had a drink since. I lost my Marine Corps career, tried selling all kinds of things, insurance and stocks and bonds and real estate and all that, and I'm just not a salesman. I can give a good sales pitch, but I'm not a closer. And I go, well, if you feel like buying it, go ahead. I don't care. you're not going to sell much doing that. And I will tell you this story and I ended up with this wonderful career with the credit union movement, and I will tell you this story. I was talking to a friend of mine, another Marine. He was a POW from Korea, and he was working on the House Banking Committee. And I said, I got to get a salary job. I can't take these commissions. And boy, the mortgage money dried up, and I haven't made a sale. My six kids. I was behind the eight ball for so long in sobriety, like 15 years. And he said, well, you know, there's a little government agency that a Marine general took over, and they're looking for a congressional liaison. I think I can get you an interview. The general counsel's a retired Marine colonel lawyer, so I went over for the interview, and they're looking for someone who knows all about credit union law and the Congress. And I, what I knew was I had a credit union account. That was the extent of my knowledge about credit unions. So I went over the interview, and of course, Marines do treat each other well, and the colonel listened, and we talked, and so on down. And he said, well, he said, I'm actually looking for somebody that, you know, already knows. I said, I can learn this fast, colonel. You know, the Marine officers, we can learn this stuff, and we can do all that. And he said, well, I'll think about it. By the way, why did you get out of the Marine Corps? And there was kind of a big moment of truth right there. And I don't know what made me say it, but I just looked at him and I said, oh, I got thrown out for drinking. But I've been in AA for 10 years. I haven't had a drink in 10 years. And he said, oh, well, okay, well, I'll let you know. And I went home and I knew that he was never going to call me. And 2 weeks later, the personnel department called up and said, if you want that job, you can have it. And I went over, and I was in the general counsel. These young lawyers were in there, and I said, what do I do? What is congressional liaison? I had a desk. And they said, oh, you write all the general's speeches and his testimony. And he's testifying on a big banking bill in 3 weeks. And you have to write it. And then I found out that this guy just had it. His name was Herman the German. And it was just the way they talked about him. Says, boy, when his secretary comes back here, you better start shaking. I hadn't even seen him yet. So anyway, I'm in the thing, and they give me the bill and the summary of it and all the credit union provisions. And there was a history book in there about the credit union movement. And it was like reading the history of the AA movement. It was all spiritual. It was all some philanthropist named Filene in Boston saw this concept in India. He wanted to bring it to his employees. And then but they had to get laws passed. He hired this lawyer who was just totally spiritual, religious. And he just took all of the do the right to your friend and, do, you know, all these things and incorporated it into this history book that laid out how this whole thing should be done. And I was so fascinated with it. It was like reading the history of our big book and the history of AA with these coincidences and how this turned out and how it all, people helping people, little tiny things. And, you know, generally they'd be in a manufacturing plant and they'd start a little credit union in the corner. So I read this whole thing and I was just so inspired by it. So as I went to write about the proposals, I just used the principles that I had just read about in there. It was almost like applying the 12 steps to the your comments on a proposal. So I'm just putting all this stuff in, flowery, spiritual, the whole thing, and send it up to the general. And about 2 hours later, his secretary came back. General wants to see you right now. So I went up there, and there he was. And I hadn't even met him. He said, sit down. He said, you write this? I said, yes, sir. This is great. Now, I think the next day I went back to, you know, fine-tune a few things. This is great. How'd you get this? This is great. Well, I'm tired of that crap they were sending up here, you know, legalese. So, like, 3 days later, he's coming back with his arm around me, walking back into the to the other lawyers, and I'm looking at them. And so much so, while I'm on this, geez, about 2 years later, there was a misunderstanding about what we were supposed to testify about. And he covered just a very small portion, because we've already covered the rest. And this staff guy that really didn't like us had given Senator McIntyre, who's another Marine, he was from Vermont, I think, he gave him these cards with these questions, and all the credit union people are in the back, the trade association, and the questions were, "General, you haven't addressed what this committee wants. You've avoided addressing all the questions that we want answered. I can't believe you come up here. You're just getting a big lecture off of this card." And I could see smoke coming out of the general's ears, and I knew that my job was over. I mean, I just had that feeling. I wasn't even looking. And he came back and sat over to the side. He didn't come back where we were. And I said, I just went over. I couldn't take it. I just went over and sat down next to him. And I said something about, "You know, General, I'm real sorry we did that." He just said, "Screw him." He was mad at them. He wasn't mad at us at all. And the last thing is, the colonel and I were about the same age, and we became kind of friends. And I was at his house one day a couple years later, and he said, "Did you ever wonder why I hired you?" And I said, "Yes, sir, to tell you the truth." And this is what he said. He said, "I just wondered what it would be like to work with someone that honest." That was what he said to me. So I'm not telling you that if somebody asks you what the problem is, you tell them you got thrown out for drinking and all of that. But I'm just telling you what happened with me. And I stayed with that and retired to Tampa off of that job. And I loved every minute of it. And I mostly wrote speeches and testimony and had a great time. So God was good to me in sobriety in ways that I never planned. And just to tell you about my financial thing, when I was 55, I had no chance of retiring. I mean, I was looking in the bank, and I said, "You're going to be working forever." And I was at the 10 years at the government agency, and the trade association liked my work so much, they offered me a raise if I would leave there and go with them. And I said, "Okay." Because we see them all the time. They're in the same circle. And so I was getting ready to leave the agency, and the personnel lady called me in, and she said, "You know, you're leaving the same time the head of the agency's leaving. It's going to trigger early retirement." And I went, "Early retirement? I've only been here 10 years. I didn't get early retirement." She said, all those years in the Marine Corps count, which other people would have known, but I didn't keep track of that. So all of a sudden, my whole career in the Marine Corps, when I got thrown out, was not wasted. It all came back together. And I just somehow ended up down in Tampa with enough money to meet my expenses and eat out almost every day. And as I told you, eating out is one of my favorite things after meetings, is to get together with people. So I would say that God took pretty good care of me. In the sense that I never saw any hope for retiring or anything. So that's kind of my background. What time are we supposed to stop this?
15 minutes.
Huh? All right, 15. All right, well, then maybe we can get through a few of these. I know everybody's tired, but we'll... And remember I said if I didn't get to it and you want it answered... Oh, boy, I never should have said God was everything. If God is everything, then why? The Big Bang. That's right. Why would he allow extreme human suffering, the Holocaust, AIDS, etc.? And it is. Whys are dead end questions. I mean, I used to ask them all the time, and part of me wants to ask them now. Part of me wants to go, "Yeah! Yeah! What about this?" But it goes nowhere. Every time I've worked it through, it's a dead end. I get there, and you know what happens when you get there? Then you go, "Yeah, but why that?" Well, then you got to start in on that. And then, so you end up all the way back at the Big Bang.
The way to keep the ego busy.
Huh?
The way to keep the ego busy.
Well, it sure does. And you feel good about it. It's a cause. When allowing an addict Allowing an addict to work the 12 steps of AA, substituting alcohol for drugs, aren't they lying to themselves and not being completely honest every time when asked at the beginning of an AA meeting if they are an alcoholic? And is this detrimental to their recovery? Shouldn't they admit to their real addiction at some time? The only people that I'm familiar with are people who are alcoholics and have something else. I've never personally had any experience with someone who took drugs but had no problem when they drank. Do you follow what I'm saying? There may be people like that, or who took drugs and never, ever took a drink in their life. So they have no familiarity, no history with alcohol whatsoever. I've just never run into that. The person who that I run into is they have a terrible problem with drugs. They also, when they drink, have a terrible problem with alcohol, which makes them an alcoholic. And they could have a terrible problem with gambling. But if they have the same experience with alcohol that I do, then we can connect on that level, and that's the only level I want to connect on. That's what primary purpose is. It's the person who is going to establish the trust with the other person. They have to be able to connect at a very deep level on one common area. I remember when I was new and we would get a periodic. I would go, a periodic? You mean an alcoholic who doesn't drink for 3 months and then starts again? And they would send somebody else on the 12-step call. You follow what I'm saying? Because the connection would be deeper with another periodic. They don't do that anymore, but that was the feeling that we had. We want the person who goes on a 12-step call or who's going to be connecting and getting his trust to be able to connect as close as possible. So if I am trying to connect with someone where they're describing a needle and I'm describing a bottle, and they go, I hide my needle in there, and well, I hide my bottle over here, it's the same thing. And they describe putting the needle in their arm, and I go, yeah, I know how you feel. I don't know how they feel. I've got a clue how they feel. So we limit the connection to alcohol. That's how I have handled these. And so this would lead me to think that this is a person who has no problem with alcohol and has a problem with drugs, and yes, they would be misrepresenting themselves at an AA meeting because they have no problem with alcohol. But I have never met anybody like that. Generally, if you're an addict and you try anything, you don't do it in moderation. So anyway, I know that one could go on forever. And there's probably 13 different opinions in this room. Do you find compromising your truth in a conflict with a loved one in order to facilitate peace? If so, what is the spiritual price that you pay? You pay a spiritual price with the compromising every time. In the short run, it looks like you've avoided pain by compromising on the truth, by saying, well, no, that doesn't bother me that much, or whatever. But in the long run, you lose the game completely. Because once they find out you've been compromising, they lose respect for you. They don't say, oh, well, thank you for being extra understanding. It ends up just blowing up later on. And so the truth may seem hard, but it's always the best course to follow. And I know that when we come out with it, it may cause that moment right there, but then that gets resolved. Anyway, that's my take on that. And I've been in situations like that, and I know how easy it is to try and avoid it, say something that is something comfortable so we can move on. Can you talk about the four absolutes? Honesty, love, unselfishness, and purity, part of the Oxford movement. I think I mentioned that there's a pamphlet. If you ever want to read a full discussion, go online to the Cleveland Intergroup, and you can order a pamphlet called The Four Absolutes with about a page and a half on each one. And they're handed out in meetings, different groups out there. That'll be right on the table with all the other AA literature, The Four Absolutes.
And Sandy, what were they again before?
Honesty, unselfishness, love, and purity. And, I mean, the steps cover them. I mean, these are character defects or their attributes, and so it's not that we never talk about honesty or not talk about love or not talk about unselfishness or purity, lust. It's just that they aren't laid out with the word absolute. And that was the big debate, and clearly in the Akron, Cleveland area, they felt they should be right there in the new guy's face the day he walks in. You've got to get absolute. This, and they were, you know, it was a much stronger pitch. And Bill felt, and New York felt, that that stuff was going to be too hard for alcoholics who are shooting for perfection, all or nothing, and that they're going to have absolute honesty from the day they get here, and that we'll sneak it in later, that we start with, let's just stop drinking for now, and then we'll move down the path, and the path gets narrower. And we all know the spiritual path gets narrower. What you could get away with in 5 years sobriety, you can't get away with yourself, with 15 years. Suddenly it's just, boy, I got to stop doing this. So it was just a question of what was the best way to handle new people. And there was a big disagreement between New York and the Midwest. I know death is normal, but do you honestly have no fear of dying, or do you have some fear? My ego has a lot of fear. My ego realizes that's the end of his game. And so that part, but as you make the spiritual connection, you realize that it's, we're really returning home, and that it's going to be remarkable. It's just going to be wonderful. So, yes, the ego has fear that it'll have no role to play. But I would say, no, I have no fear of dying. I have fear of suffering during death. I have fear of pain and things like that. But the unknown, I don't have any qualms about that at all. Do you ever feel like the work you're doing in AA, meeting, sponsoring, is enough? Do you ever feel that it's enough? No, it's never enough. I mean, we are driven to achieve as close a resemblance to our higher power as possible, which would be to express infinite love. And I am nowhere near that. But I hope to keep improving in that area. So it's not something I beat myself up with. It's something that I know is a natural part of spirituality, which is to do more. And it's not so much as doing more as being more. You will be more spiritual. And in that being, more gets done than you can do now, if you follow what I'm saying on that. So, on the other hand, if you're beating yourself up over not doing more, then that's a separate thing. That's the ego giving you a hard time trying to actually ruin your spirituality. All right, guys. Think we can take three more? Is there any time when thinking about self is good, a positive thing? For it is by self-forgetting the one finds. Thinking about self is a good thing. Well, you could make a case for that. You could make a case that selfishness and thinking about self is how the downward journey is done. And after you crash and are coming back, you're grateful for all the self-thinking that you did, because it got you down even further. What we want to be doing is seeking the real self. The real self. And this may sound funny, but I would submit that self-love is the highest form of love that there is. Love of self is the highest form of love. Why is that? Because our true self, our true nature, is pure love. And when you think of the admonition to love your neighbor as yourself, if you hate yourself, your neighbor is not going to get a very good deal. In other words, it begins with acknowledging our own connection to divinity. That is our true nature. And we can't help but love that. So that is the self that we're talking about. The other self is the ego self, and thinking about that is a total waste of time. And so that's what St. Francis is, by self-forgetting that one finds. And what do we find? Our true self, our true nature, God, whatever you want to call it. So there's the phony and the real. Two to go. If we want to be willing, even earnestly believe we are willing to have God remove our defects so we can get out of our own way, but sense that we're unwilling, almost at a muscular level, how can we release that resistance, that reluctance? Okay, so we're basically describing the fight that we have with ourselves. And I remember Chuck Chamberlain. There's a DVD of Chuck giving a talk to a university here. Does anybody know? Do you know what university that was, Steve? It's kind of a scratchy one, but he's talking to students at a university, and I think he just got kind of invited in there, and I'm not sure the students were thrilled that somebody was coming in the 70s talking about spirituality. Oh, really? Spirituality. And he started out with this attention getter. He said, you all here in college, and you're studying a lot of things. But I doubt if you're going to find the answer to the most important problem that human beings have. And that problem is how to be at peace with yourself. And you could see that suddenly there was a little more tension as he, because everyone in the room realized they weren't at peace with themselves. And he went from there talking about spirituality. And being at peace with ourselves is having this battle finally end. And you could call it the battle between good and evil, willingness and unwillingness, or the ego and the heart. And of course it's a struggle. That's why we're here. So when we have this thing, I can't get the willingness, and how am I going to overcome it? It feels like it's a muscular unwillingness. That's how hard we want to fight to continue to keep the ego story going. And surrendering this whole, all this territory is not an easy battle. But every time we score a victory, we realize, well, damn, why didn't I do that sooner? Why didn't I do that sooner? And so I wish I could comment on how to cause this to happen sooner. What is the perfect way to have this battle over with? I just think that's up to God. We just realize that we're powerless. There's no way we can win this battle. There's no way. This battle has to be won by surrendering. It has to be the white flag. God, I now acknowledge I can't not win this thing. And there's a part of us that doesn't want to put the white flag up. It does not want to just go, I'm unconditionally surrendering. We want to dictate some of the surrender terms. You follow what I'm saying? And that keeps us in the battle. It keeps us, couldn't I just keep part of the territory? Couldn't I be just in charge of greed? I'll give up everything else. Could I have just the greed territory that I'll be in charge of? So you're describing a thing that's going on inside of all of us in this room now, and we're further along than we were. But God help us. I wish we could all just get there and all white flags come up. Game's over. Huh. I have not been able to be in an intimate relationship in over 20 years now. Plenty of friendships and intrigues, but not the real thing. How can I have an intimate relationship in my life? First, and I really relate to this, because there are many in our midst that are exactly in that. And I think Bill talks a little bit about that in the 12 and 12, that what we have to offer to AA. And then he makes comments that those of us that aren't married or in a relationship, we have more time to do this and that and become more useful and so on down. The thought that I have is, accept this until we're comfortable with it. Make not having an intimate relationship acceptable. Ask for the grace to be absolutely happy with not being in an intimate relationship. And many times, the spiritual lesson is the acceptance of the situation, and once we pass the test, a relationship shows up. Sometimes people they want to quit their job. Can't stand it. It's the worst goddamn job. The people in there, the boss and the next boss, and etc. And I'll say to them, okay, I think you should start looking for a job. I agree with you. That's a terrible situation that you have. But before you actually quit and look for another job, use your program, use all of the powers of forgiveness, use all the powers of understanding to get comfortable at the job you're at, and then quit. And so they go, oh, they take it. I'm still quitting. So I'm, okay, I'm going to be more understanding of my boss. I'm going to do this. I'm going to show that I have the power to get comfortable with this unacceptable situation as a spiritual exercise prior to quitting. And then you get comfortable so you don't quit. In other words, you transform the way you were looking at this. Or you may quit because something better comes along, but it won't be out of anger or out of character defects. It'll be out of a sense of this would be a better opportunity rather than because I can't handle my anger or resentments in the present job. And I really think that if sometimes when we look at that, the demand to have the intimate relationship is maybe ruining the chances of having one, because we can sense this person is angry at something and I don't want to be in a relationship with them. So my suggestion is to spiritually attempt to have it be fine that you're not in an intimate relationship and then see what happens. The box is empty. I thank you for all of the wonderful questions you thought up. And, now, if you want to say something, say it out loud right now. Hi. So we're going to start right now with the period of silence. And it'll go until after supper, and we're back here, I think it's 7:30. And so let me just start this period of silence with a prayer. And we're all in it now. God, we ask that we commune with you in a quiet manner, and that you enable us in the silence to experience a different level of union with you and with our dear friends. May you bless our efforts at this period of silence and allow us to learn everything that you can give to us. Amen.